Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. I just want to say a massive thank you to everyone that's been listening. Our audience has been growing a lot recently, so there must be a lot of new people coming on board. So welcome to the podcast. Really hope you're enjoying it. I'm definitely having a ball putting the episodes together, so keep going and we'll keep putting content out. If you're enjoying what we're doing and you want to support the Downtime Podcast and help us keep going, then you can grab yourself a t-shirt or a sweatshirt over on our store. Head to downtimepodcast.com/shop and have a look. Massive thank you to everyone that's already bought a t-shirt or a sweatshirt. It means a lot. Really hope you're enjoying them. And yeah, hope they fit and look good. All right, we've got another episode for you. It's a bonus one this week with the first round of the UCI Downhill World Cup coming up. We sat down and we talked to Simon Burney. Simon looks after the mountain bike racing side of things for the UCI. He's at all of the events and he's got a real insight onto everything that's going on. I was interested to find out a little bit more about the challenges that the UCI have and the things that they're doing to help improve the sport, help grow it, and putting on races for us to all watch. We talk about the impact of Red Bull Media and what that's done to the sport. We talk about what the technical delegates do at a race and how busy their job is. And we also touch on whether Schladming, the amazing venue, will ever be seen back on the World Cup circuit again. So without further ado, here's Simon Burney. Simon Burney, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking time out of your day to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. So before we get stuck into talking about your current day job, can you give us a little bit of background on your time in the cycling side of things and how you've ended up where you are today?
Yeah, sure. I guess we'll keep it mountain bike specific. I kind of started out as a cyclocross rider and a road rider before mountain bikes were invented, and then at the time, I was racing as a professional cyclocross rider and training a lot with Tim Gould, who became one of the best British cross country mountain bike riders that we had. And I had a crash in a cyclocross race when I was pretty young, sort of early 20s, and I kind of had to. That was kind of a career ending crash, and I went straight into kind of managing a team with Tim and David Baker. And this was kind of late 80s, and we were sponsored by Peugeot. And the year after we started the cyclocross team, Peugeot brought out their first mountain bikes. So they just said, oh, can you take some bikes and go and have a play around and go do some races? So we kind of went and did some of the British races and kind of started out at the top level with those guys, because they were very, very high level in road racing and cyclocross, and they kind of took to mountain bikes really quite easily at the time. And yeah, just kind of went on from there with professional cross-country teams, sort of late 80s, went to the World Championships in 88, 89, and then Tim was third in the first World Championships in UCI World Championships in Durango in 90. And then kind of went on from there. So I did the whole of the 90s managing mountain bike teams, and then I went to British Cycling for the Sydney Olympics 2000, and I did two Olympic cycles with them as the kind of the performance manager for off-road, which was mountain bike and a little bit of BMX when that came in for the first Olympics. And then, yeah, I've been at UCI since 2007 and started as a technical delegate for cross country, and then kind of moved more into the kind of the event side of the World Cup and a little bit more with the kind of the coordination of the whole sport of mountain bike.
Interesting. Before we get into the UCI days, then, tell us a little bit about what performance manager involves at British Cycling. What kind of stuff are you getting involved in there?
Well, because obviously the funded programs there are all about the Olympic disciplines. So it was a lot about, the sort of the two Olympics I did was just the selection and the preparation of the riders for those Olympics, really. But then obviously that takes in World Championships and World Cups and kind of whatever preparation you're doing for those races. It's just like a big planning phase, really. It's like a 4 year of planning just to kind of based on the Olympics. But obviously, every year you've got a World Championships, and World Championships includes obviously downhill as well. So I was kind of managing the downhill side of the World Championships as well as the cross country.
Okay, and are you getting involved in the kind of the technical training side of things at that point, or is it more about the overall kind of logistics of the team?
It was both. I started out doing more of the kind of the planning and the logistics, and then moved into a coaching role in the last sort of between Athens and Beijing Olympics. So kind of, 2005, 2007, I was doing more kind of specific coaching as well as the planning, just the way that they changed the kind of structure of the performance departments, and the kind of, it was more coach led, and it just meant that they did away with the kind of the need for like team managers, and it was more kind of coach driven. So I just kind of morphed into a coaching role rather than team manager role.
Yeah. And was there anything kind of novel or unique being trialed in the training kind of area when you were involved with British Cycling back then?
I mean, not novel. I think, you know, obviously British Cycling have got a reputation now for the kind of the being excellent coaches across all the disciplines. So there were, you know, there was a lot of stuff that they were trying in other disciplines, that mountain bike kind of came quite a way down the pecking order as far as funding goes, and kind of resources and time and ability to use some of the other specialists that maybe the track could, you know, like UK Sport have got, and the EIS, the English Institute of Sport, had got some really kind of cutting edge, you know, whatever technology, whether it's video analysis or, you know, testing, this kind of stuff. And, you know, we could kind of, we could dock into it every now and again, but it wasn't really something that we had full access to. So you kind of, you got little snippets of it, a little taste of it, and you could kind of try it and then understand how it worked and try and go away and do your own thing. So, you know, we were able to do, if we use video analysis as an example, we were able to eventually start to take some of the EIS video analysis specialists to world championships so they could work with the downhillers. So, you know, things like that, which was at the time was, you know, the French were doing it a bit when downhill, but, you know, we were kind of up there with the best of what was available, was kind of resources and support for the team at Worlds, for sure.
Interesting. So what's the, can you tell us a little bit more about the video analysis side of things? What kind of stuff is that capable of, or was it capable of then?
A lot of it, I think, again, I was leaving it to them, and also those guys were then feeding back to the riders. I was kind of a little bit more a World Championships overall managing it, not real with specifics, but a lot of it's the kind of the, I think it's like dartfish analysis, where you kind of shadow two or three riders over the same section, and you can kind of see where entry speeds, exit speeds, different line choices. And then you've just got a lot of more statistics on top of that, kind of with speed and with, yeah, it's just basically looking at, you can break a course down into so many sections and you can video them all, and you can kind of work out line choices, basically what you're trying to do. And just, yeah, again, just a lot of, you know, I said, going into sections, how fast you're going, which line you're taking, where your breaking points are, your exit speed, which then obviously carries into the next section. So, and it's good because, again, at the time, because there weren't too many nations doing it, you could kind of get a lot of information from other nations' riders as well. So, you know, you'd be filming at the time, whoever it was, you know, Steve P and G, but you could also be, you know, looking at the French and the Australians, and you kind of see what they're doing as well. So it gave rise to some good, you know, good information and good kind of feedback sessions after training.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize they were doing that. That's interesting stuff. Cool. Yeah. So just remind me again, what's your current job title at the UCI, and what can you translate that for us and tell us kind of what that means as to what you get up to?
Yeah, it's actually changed since January the 1st, really. So I work as a consultant for the UCI. I'm not an employee, so I don't get a job title as such. So I was kind of the mountain bike coordinator, but with some recent changes, it's meant that the coordinators have to be kind of office-based full-time employees. So I'm pretty much now just like, you know, a consultant mountain bike expert. But effectively, it hasn't changed my actual the role that I'm doing, which is working kind of closely with the mountain bike coordinator and the assistant coordinator, which are both office based. But I'm more kind of responsible for the event coordination as far as the World Cup and the World Championships go. So I'm at all the events. So there isn't normally anybody else that's UCI office based at the events. So yeah, I'm at all the World Cups, I'm at the Championships, I'm at the Olympics. And kind of around that, obviously the actual kind of the management of the discipline, you know, involving whatever rule changes, commission meetings, and just kind of the day-to-day running, you know, answering questions from federations and from teams. And obviously within mountain bike, we've got the UCI team registration. It kind of day-to-day, it's a lot of just kind of answering emails and kind of catching up with the calendar and the kind of the planning for the following year. But then I'm the kind of the guy on the ground at the events. I'm sort of the UCI guy that's, you know, the old races. So I'm the kind of the consistent figure at the big events.
Okay, good stuff. And so within the UCI, what's the rest of the structure for downhill? I guess you mentioned an assistant coordinator and a coordinator. I know there's a technical delegate as well, I think. Is that still David Vasquez?
Yeah, so full-time staff. So the off-road department at the UCI comprises, yeah, mountain bike, cyclocross, BMX, and trials. Now, the actual total number of people in that whole department probably doesn't count to more than 8 or 10, I would guess. And in mountain bike specific, there's just Annalise, who's the coordinator, Caroline, who's the assistant coordinator, and myself. So there's kind of, you know, the department is pretty much three people as far as mountain bike goes. And that's just the discipline as a whole. So it's not split between downhill and cross country. The kind of the technical delegates almost fill a similar role to commissaires, where they're not employed. They're just kind of they're on a day rate for the work they do. So we just appoint a technical delegate like we would appoint a commissaire for an event. Right now we use David Vasquez and Jorge Garcia, the two Spanish guys for downhill, and Beat Varbel for cross country in a technical delegate role. And they just do, between those guys, they do the World Cup, World Championships, Continental Championships as well. So outside of Europe, we try to send a technical delegate to those, because again, it's a little bit of a learning process for the confederation to kind of try and improve their events as well. So this year we're sending somebody to Oceania in New Zealand, to Colombia for the Pan American, African, they only tend to do cross country right now, depending on the country that host it, whether they have a downhill or not. And Asia, we normally send somebody to the Asian Championships as well.
Okay, and so then they're kind of the technical delegates are more responsible for the course and listening to the riders' concerns. Is that right?
Yeah. So the technical delegate is pretty much 100% course specific. So it's a little bit of work before the event, working with the organisers if they've got questions about changes they want to make to a course. Obviously, we're tending now to go to World Cups on a fairly consistent basis, so the guys know the courses. It's more about anything that's changing, how courses are marked. And then once they actually arrive on site at an event, they do, well, they're on the course the whole time, but the kind of the two key tasks when they first get there, they do a TV walk first to see where the TV have set up kind of camera positions, scaffold platforms, where there may be one line of sight from a particular camera angle that means the course maybe needs to be retaped or to keep spectators out of a particular area to get a line of sight for cameras. And then they'll do, that's normally on day one, then day two, it's the UCI official walk, where that's more about the safety aspect. So they'll do the TDs or do that walk with the commissaire and the event organizer. And that's more about safety, medical, evacuation, as well as kind of anything that's potentially likely to change as far as whatever the course surface or anything that needs, you know, if any roots need chopping out or any rocks need moving or, pads on trees, bridges, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, then that second inspection happens a few hours before the first on-foot inspection for the riders. So then if anything needs changing, then there's a few hours before the riders first see the course, which is their walking inspection. And again, then the way we tend to work it is that we leave one, because in downhill we use two technical delegates. We tend to leave one on the course running around, repairing stuff, keeping an eye on it. And then we kind of leave one, which is normally David, at the bottom in the finish bowl, especially during walking practice, to get any feedback from the riders. So they kind of, if they see something that's been missed, then, you know, he's a familiar face now. They go find him and have a chat. And then he can be on the radio up to Jorge, who's on the course, to make any changes or anything that need happening.
Okay. Yeah. There's clearly a huge amount of thought and preparation that goes into that side of things that I guess a lot of us will take for granted. It's maybe not obvious.
Yeah, I mean, those guys, they're pretty much, they start with a marshal briefing at usually 6 o'clock in the morning, and they don't usually finish until we have an end of day meeting with UCI, organization, television, medical, that happens between sort of 6:30, 7 o'clock every evening. But between the sort of, in that 12 hours, they're full on. It is hard. And obviously, you know, it's up and down the course a lot as well. So it's not easy. They're either going up on the uplift and walking down, or they're running up and down. So it's a lot of work and a lot of stress for them, actually. It's hard because it's a lot of responsibility. And I think with that, they're both ex-riders. They know exactly, you know, David's won World Cups. He's been, you know, a very, very good rider for a long time. He knows exactly what's needed. And it's hard for those guys when things maybe aren't going right. They've only got, you know, one pair of hands, and they can only do so much at a time. So it is difficult. And they're trying to work with the organization's course guys. They're trying to work with television as well, which is now a big part of what we're trying to do, is trying to, you know, improve the television product. So yeah, they've got full days.
Yeah, so Fort William this year, or sorry, 2017, I guess, is a good example of the sort of challenges they faced. There was the wood section that received a huge amount of heavy rain in the run up to the event, and there was, I guess, a couple of riders voicing strong concerns, and then, you know, the way that it made some of the riders look on the TV product as well.
For sure. You know, that's, we learn a lot of lessons in Fort William, and also the week after in Leo Gang, we had not a similar issue, but we had another problem there with the kind of the jump at the finish. And again, you know, the TDs came in for a lot of criticism over those two events. And, you know, again, I'm looking at it from the inside. I know how hard they were working to try to make some of those issues better, but I also know how many different directions they were being pulled in. And it was, we learned a lot. You know, we learned a lot about prioritizing how they're working, and the kind of also the communication, you know, that's happening. Because again, there's a lot of people involved in creating a course and working on a course. Both of those races, they weren't perfect, and we're the first to acknowledge that one. And hopefully, you know, what we've learned there, it'll mean that we won't get repeats of that. And, you know, before that, we hadn't really had too many issues. You know, for a couple of years, there's always something on the course. There's always something that a rider, you know, maybe doesn't like. And there's big, in downhill especially, there's big variations in opinion on what's needed, or what's expected, and, you know, what some riders like and what some don't like. So it's a bigger picture stuff. You know, we're trying to move away from the kind of the bike parky courses that we were seeing like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, to try and go a bit more natural. But then natural comes with its own challenges, like we saw in Fort William. Obviously, that was a new section that they put in. It was relatively fresh ground. It had been, you know, we had the weather issue. There was a lot of stuff going on, but again, it's just trying to balance and try to kind of keep the sport moving forward, to try and challenge the riders to make courses that are safe, that give a good rider experience. The riders are the forefront of everything we're doing, but again, you know, we want to try to transfer what the riders are experiencing onto television. You know, and obviously, with the Red Bull Media House now doing the television coverage, they're pulling out some, you know, amazing pictures, and we're getting really, really good coverage from that. And again, from what we're seeing on the television, is really helping the organisers and us and the TDs as well, you know, kind of with what we'd like to see courses developing, you know, in the next year or two to you know, try and improve again what we're seeing on the television to try and get a bigger fan base and to make the racing as exciting as it currently is.
Yeah, I mean, the addition of Red Bull Media House to the sport, certainly for me as an average rider sat at home, has been fantastic in that it's enabled me to sit and live stream a really, really good product, you know, a decent amount of camera footage from quite a lot of the races these days, good commentary team, and, you know, the course pre-rides and all this kind of stuff's been really good. What do you think Red Bull Media House have brought to the sport? Because I guess there's a flip side to that in that they have a level of say, and they also maybe want certain things that are challenging to deliver and maintain the integrity of downhill as a sport, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's the balance that we all need to try to find. They are very, very sympathetic to the demands of the sport. They haven't come in heavy-handed and said, you know, we want to change X, Y, Z dramatically. They're trying to work within a budget. That's the important thing. They've got a budget for each of their broadcasts. Now, that has a knock-on effect to the number of cameras they can use, the number of people that they bring. And obviously, it is a lot. It's significant, but it does mean that they still can't show everything on the course. So then it's about, from their point of view, it's they're trying to show the best of the course with the cameras they've got available. And then around that, we're trying to make the courses fit that to an extent, but we're not doing it. We're still doing it with the absolute of keeping the sport as integral with the kind of the demands and what the riders want to see. A good example is probably Fort William. You know, that from a TV point of view, they'd love to see the top, whatever, 2 minutes gone and start near the deer fence, a third of the way down. But, you know, the kind of the demands then on the organizer, when they've got a start house there, they've got the top of the gondola, which is perfect for riders warming up. It's a bit, not a standoff as such, but it's a discussion every year at the kind of the organizer seminar that we have. TV say, I don't suppose we can move the start down. And we're like, well, no, not really. You know, that's the kind of the way it is. And it's a balance, you know? So they understand it, they get it. And they've been very sympathetic to kind of what the sport means, you know, and what the riders want. So they don't make too many demands at all. They try and fit in with us to the biggest extent, for sure. Cool. So yeah. But I think, you know, from what you're saying, what they brought to it, I think they've just brought the a better understanding to the fan base that are watching it of what the riders are actually doing. It's very hard to see unless you're standing by the track. You know, you see some of the sections that they're riding and the speed that they're going, and it's phenomenal. And a lot of kind of sports where riders are the best in the world at doing something, they make it look easy. And I think what Red Bull have done is actually, you know, have been very good at showing how difficult some of the things are. You know, whether it's just from the technology that they're using and the camera positions and just the way they're able to show the sport. I think it shows how good the riders are that are competing at the top.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I've had quite a few friends that have seen mountain biking through the Red Bull coverage and have been, you know, impressed by it, especially when you see them at places like Val d'Isol. I think it does seem to blow people's minds, which a lot of the footage back in the day, people seem to struggle to contemplate how hard that really was. So,
yeah, I think a good analogy is like, yeah, you know, skiing. I used to watch, you know, Ski Sunday when I was, you know, growing up, and you sort of looking at it thinking, well, yeah, that's pretty good. And I think it was only when I actually went to a ski area that was on a World Cup course, and you see how steep it is. And again, I was watching it recently, and again, just the way they've changed the way they film stuff, you can actually see now how steep it is and how big the jumps are and how, you know, how dramatic it all is. And I think that's what Red Bull have done with downhill as well.
Yeah, it's a good addition. So you've got obviously quite a lot of different parties with, you know, with an interest in the sport that are potentially pulling in different directions. I'm kind of interested in how all that lot balances out. So you've kind of got the UCI, the teams, the riders themselves, Red Bull Media House, your sponsors, and then the venues. Where does the power lie within that? Like, or how well does everyone work together?
I think right now it works pretty well. I think everybody has an opportunity to have their opinion heard. And I think that starts with the riders. Again, you know, we try to take everything back to the riders because the riders are that's why we're here. That's why we're doing it. So the riders have a voice through a rider representative who's on the Mountain Bike Commission. So in the last 4 year cycle, that's been Greg Minnaar. We've managed to get an addition to that. So we've now got Pom Pom as well. So we've got her and Greg, and those are voted for by the riders. So they were voted in by the riders at the World Championships in Cairns. So yeah, we've got Miriam, we've got Greg, and then we've also got two cross country athlete representatives. So they're the ones that can get opinion from riders. Obviously, if you've got whatever 150 riders say at a World Cup race with the men and the women, it's a lot of different opinion and a lot of different views and different kind of, everyone's got something to say. It's easy to kind of channel that. Now there's two ways of doing it. You can either channel it through the rider reps or you can channel it through team managers. And again, we've got the UCI teams and we've got the 15 elite teams. And we try to have an elite team meeting kind of two or three times a year. And that's kind of historically been the way that I've tried to effect change with either events or with rules or things. It's been through the kind of those team meetings. And again, you know, even with a group of 15 team managers, you've got some strong personalities. You've got people that will sit in a meeting and won't say a word. You've got different ideas based on the riders that they've got on their team at that time. So you've still got to balance out the feedback that you're getting with a bigger picture look at, you know, what would happen if this rule changed 5 years down the line. Maybe those riders aren't riding for that team. Maybe that team doesn't exist anymore. Maybe that team manager's, you know, gone to car racing. Yeah, there's a lot of different things to kind of bring into it. And like you said, you know, on top of that, you've got the demands of television. You've got event organisers who are, you know, who are, again, a big part of our World Cup is our organisers that have been doing it for a long time. Their costs are going up. The demands that we're putting on them as far as having, bringing television in there, you know, it's kind of costing them more. There's more people involved. We've had more riders. We've had more teams. That's taking up kind of team parking. It's taking up space. There's you know, obviously lots of people being pulled in lots of different directions. And it's just this, I think as the governing body, as the UCI, you're not going to please everybody. You can't do it. It's an impossible task. So you just have to almost put that a little bit on the back burner and look at, you know, if you're going to change something, the bigger picture reasons for making a change, the kind of, what's it going to do? How's it going to affect the sport? And again, I think right now we're just mainly talking at World Cup and World Championship level. But I think we also need to remember that the sport goes down to countries that, you know, whatever, countries in Africa and South America that we maybe don't consider in very often. And we can make a rule change that we're looking at based on whatever, you know, a European that's racing World Cup. But that rule could also affect, you know, a junior rider in Argentina that's just riding, you know, races on his local calendar. So we need to be careful that we're not alienating, that we're continuing to grow the base of the sport. Because I think downhill especially is quite top heavy. Downhill doesn't have a huge base of events on the calendar that maybe cross country does. So, you know, we just need to be very mindful that if we're making change, that we're trying to encourage growth of the sport generally, but we also need to kind of keep the top end, that World Cup focus, because that's what gives us the television coverage and creates the fan base and kind of probably motivates more the young riders to, you know, to want to be downhillers. And, you know, the first thing they then do is to try and find races they can go do. And obviously a World Cup's not going to be the first race that they try to compete in. So we need to make sure they've got a calendar that's attractive enough for them to want to take up the sport.
Yeah. And do you think there's much that the UCI can do or is doing to help bridge that gap from sort of national level through to World Cup? And it's been interesting to see in the last week or so the announcement from EWS about their continental series, which I guess is their approach to trying to help cover that gap.
Yeah, it's we work close with the federations, and I think a lot of it is the kind of federation responsibility almost. I think we have to devolve some of our responsibility to those federations, and it does vary significantly which country you're looking at, which federation, which countries have got a national series, which ones, if they've got a national series, are willing to, you know, pay calendar fees to have that on the UCI calendar with the additional prize money cost. So it's a difficult one. I'd like to see a series that's either sits alongside maybe slightly under the World Cup, that gives riders an opportunity to do a series that's a step up to the World Cup. I think we have actually limited slightly the number of riders that are going to qualify for finals in the World Cup from 80 down to 60 for this year. I'm not ashamed to say that we're trying to make it a little bit more elitist. You know, we want the best riders. And that's the show. But I think in doing that, we also need to try to figure out a way that, yeah, the riders that are coming up have got a way to, you know, maybe qualify for the World Cup through other races or through another series. And I think, you know, we're talking to organisers about that. I don't think it would be too long before that we might see that happening.
Awesome. Yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah,
good stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we look at, again, maybe not so familiar with it, but cyclocross is quite a good example where we've got a World Cup series of, you know, whatever, 8 or 9 rounds. But alongside that, there's 3 other kind of major series that all the top riders compete in that they're all on the UCI calendar. The UCI don't have anything directly connected to it. We send a commissaire, but that's it. But those series are strong enough to stand on their own. They've got an organization behind them. And we're happy to have them on the calendar. And I think, you know, mountain bike could benefit from, again, maybe just one additional series in that sort of similar scenario, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you mentioned that sort of making conscious decisions or choices to try and make the sport more elitist, more of a show. And it's been a shame, I think, for a lot of people to see a couple of top flight riders leave the series over the last couple of years with Josh Briceland and Sam Hill making decisions to step away. Yeah. How do you feel about that? And I guess, do you think there's anything more that the UCI can do to retain that sort of top level of talent within the sport?
I don't think, you know, I think in any sport or in anything in life, I think, you know, people will come and people will go. You know, people's lives change. You know, Josh, you know, he'd done it for a long time. He'd been doing it since he was a kid. And I think it comes to a point where if you've won World Cups, you still need to find the motivation to continue. And some people can find that motivation. You know, somebody like, you know, whatever, Steve Peake can just go year on year on year, just kind of still motivated. Greg Minard, they just want to win World Cups and want to win World Championships. But not everybody's like that. Some people can do 5 years, or you know, in Josh's case, probably, you know, significantly longer than that, of just, you know, the training and the focus and the dedication and wanting to win races. But once you've done that, you know, some people's motivation lies elsewhere, or just trying to find something else in life to go and do. And I think that's what Josh did, you know. And Sam, you know, obviously he's moved, and a lot of riders are interested in trying the enduro side. So, you know, I don't see it as necessarily losing riders, because every time somebody drops out, somebody pops up. So if you look in the last couple of seasons, there's names in the top 10 in World Cups that we didn't see 3 or 4 years ago. So yeah, those riders are, the names you mentioned have maybe gone away, but they're being replaced, and that'll always be the case. And we're not necessarily losing riders to the sport, because they're still involved, they're still doing things, they're still riding bikes, they're still doing enduros. So I don't really see it. I think it's just a natural evolution of what happens in the sport. I don't think it's anything to be concerned about. If we weren't getting the entries for a World Cup, or if suddenly we were losing, you know, 20 or 30 riders because they just didn't like it, or because there was something seriously wrong with the series, or yeah, they're just, you know, downhill's not for us anymore, we're going to go do something else, then that's an issue. But I think just one or two names is, yeah, I think it's just kind of par for the course, really.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. And I mean, you must have your finger pretty firmly on the pulse from the teams and the riders. Is the general feeling that things are in a good place and are heading in a good direction? I mean, the sport's certainly growing, that's for sure.
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, teams will always come and always go, and there's definitely kind of there's so much cycle industry sponsorship in teams, and it's always the challenge. And I was managing teams for 15 years, and I kind of had the same situation in the 90s where you could always get bike industry support if you got the right riders, but then trying to find the out of industry sponsors and money was always the challenge, and that's still the case. I think, you know, we've recently signed Mercedes-Benz as the title sponsor and presenting sponsor for the World Cup and for the World Championships. And I think that could be a real impetus for the teams to be able to go to out of industry sponsors and say, look, we're trying to get sponsorship for a team in a sport that's got a name like Mercedes-Benz as a title sponsor to it. And it suddenly gives it a little bit more credibility. And I think that could definitely be an impetus for them to help the teams attract more sponsorship. If you asked any team manager, they haven't got enough money. You know, that everyone's trying to find, you know, an extra bit of money, whether it's to pay the riders or to do a training camp or to, you know, develop product, whatever it is. You know, everyone wants to try and find some more money. And, you know, we're exactly the same. You know, the UCI ran the World Cup for a number of years at a loss. You know, we were kind of propping it up, desperately trying to find sponsorship for the World Cup to, you know, to make it, to balance the books, really. And it's only, you know, and again, we took a massive investment getting the Red Bull Media House guys on board initially at a big cost to the UCI to try and get the sport out there to encourage the sponsorship. And it was a real chicken and egg, but it was a real risk at the time. You know, the result is that a few years down the line, that the viewing figures have just grown year on year, and, you know, massive increase in 2017 over 2016 in the viewing figures. And with then the addition of a title sponsor for 2018 moving forward, then it's in a healthier place than it was 10 years ago, for sure. Absolutely. We've got, you know, we've had to actually introduce a minimum requirement as far as points go for a team to become registered as a UCI team, because we were just getting too many teams registering. And it doesn't sound like a problem, but the way that we attract the teams is to kind of ask the organisers of the World Cups to give them space for the team area, and the organisers were just running out of space. We kind of, you know, we've just grown too big for some venues. You know, obviously the teams have been able to invest in team structure and trucks and, you know, bigger team areas. So, yeah, we're getting too big for some venues. So we've had to kind of limit the number of teams that we can have. So we're trying to go for kind of, you know, quality over quantity all the way through, really. You know, we don't want to lose people to the sport, but I think if we can have a strong flagship World Cup, World Championships, then I think that will always encourage the base. You know, that'll encourage more people to come into the sport and encourage hopefully more events as well.
Yeah, good. And so what, I mean, you mentioned earlier that you feel that there's a direction to try and bring back some of the more technical stuff and to move away as much as possible from the more bike parky terrain. What do you think is the future of downhill in your eyes at World Cup level?
Again, I think a lot of that's just on feedback. I think the riders like to, they want to have fun and they want to be challenged. And I think that happens on a more natural course. But the natural courses create a lot more work for everybody involved. But you know, that's something we have to work around that. I don't see huge changes, honestly. I think all the teams would like to see more rounds in the World Cup. Right now, where we're at, we've got more downhill rounds than cross-country rounds because the cross-country guys tend to have more other opportunities in their calendar to do other big races, whether it's a stage race like Cape Epic, or they can more easily find big events. So the downhillers maybe can't do that as much. They've got another handful of races that they can do if they want to go do them. And so there's things like Crankworx, which is growing and which definitely gets the support. But I think as far as courses go, I think where we're at now is going in the right direction. And it's, yeah, just a little bit more natural. I think the race lengths, we've got a good range of course and race lengths. We don't want to go any longer than Fort William because then we have trouble with the TV coverage. We're going to go quite short, I think, in Lozenge, the first round this year, because it's a shorter course. So I think that'll be the shortest one that we'll have seen for a while. So I think, you know, we've got a good range of race length. And again, I think, you know, from my point of view, I'd just like to see a World Cup that covers, once you've got a World Cup champion that's crowned at the end of the season, that they've won that based on their ability over a lot of different courses. And, you know, that it's not just eight races the same that are all whatever, you know, 2.5 minutes long on a course like this, that they've had short courses, long courses, they've had some natural stuff, they've had some big jumps, they've had mud, they've had whatever else you throw at them. And at the end of it, they've come out as a World Cup champion. I think that's the kind of season I'd like to see. It's mixed up a little bit. I'd be quite happy to see an urban, if you can increase the number of rounds to, you know, I think we've got eight now for downhill. You know, if we can go, you know, sort of between 8 and 10, and you maybe throw an urban one in just to mix it up a little bit, I'd like that. I don't, you know, the feedback I've had from the teams is maybe they wouldn't, but again, I'll only give you my personal opinion. I wouldn't kind of force it on anybody. I'd always, you know, go to the teams and the riders before I make a decision about it. But just things like that. I think, you know, just mix it up a little bit and just every now and again throw something in just almost to see if it works. If it doesn't work, that's fine. We'll, you know, we can go back to do something else. I'm not afraid to try something, you know, in case it doesn't work. You know, again, with cross country, we tried introducing the eliminator and we tried it for a couple of years. It didn't work. We've moved on. We're going to try something else. And I don't see it as a failure. It didn't work, but I don't think I think we did the right thing trying. I'd be equally as enthusiastic trying something if there was something out there that somebody wanted to try. No?
Yeah. Good stuff. Okay. Thanks. There's one venue that I think sticks out in a lot of people's heads, riders and spectators included, and that's Schladming. Is that ever an opportunity to go back there, or has the sport outgrown the capacity of that venue?
I haven't been for a while, actually. Not since the last time we had a World Cup there. But interestingly, Christoph Tritcher, who's the boss of the Red Bull production at the World Cups, he was actually involved in the organisation of the Schladming events. So he talks about it quite often, kind of obviously, you know, quite fondly. My understanding is that they've done a lot of construction around the bottom and would struggle with space for the teams. And again, I'm only, right. I haven't been, so I don't know if this is true or not. The other issue we've got is we've already got an established race in Leogang, which is in the same country. And right now we try not to do two in the same country if we've got good alternatives. So it would be a case of, you know, Leogang missing out and being replaced by Schladming. So, and again, we also need an organizer. The way it works is that we have to, we get bids from organizers. And if nobody wants to organize an event in Schladming, then, you know, we're not race organizers. We need somebody to do that on our behalf. We just coordinate the series. So again, if we're not getting offers, then yeah, we're not going to go there.
Yeah, totally fair. So we're getting close to the end of our time, but there's one area that we haven't touched on that I'd like to, and that's the women's side of the sport, to get your thoughts on that. I think there's been some changes from the UCI side over the last couple of years, with reducing the numbers of women that can qualify and the introduction of the junior women's category in recent times. Any thoughts on how that side of the sport's going and how those changes have impacted, whether that's positive or negative?
If we start with the junior women, I think we've always had a problem encouraging junior women into the sport. So we tried to give them their own category just to encourage them to be racing against their peer group and not against... It must be quite intimidating, obviously, racing against, as a 17-year-old, racing against elite women that have been doing it for a long time. And we don't get great numbers, honestly. You know, we've never had more than, you know, 10 riders in a junior race. And the number of elite women that we're getting, we still need to create competition. We still need to create a scenario where you need to qualify for something. The level at the top of the women's racing is incredible. You know, the kind of their ability has moved on leaps and bounds. And what we need to do is to try and kind of get more depth in that sort of top 20. The difference in time between, you know, the top five and the top 25 in quali is quite significant. But I think, you know, I don't think it's just necessarily a case of allowing more riders to qualify. I think we still need almost more of the races for them to be able to go and, you know, learn the sport and to develop. And I think for the women especially is where a second series could be really valuable to kind of give them a stepping stone to World Cup. Because again, I think as a woman, I think if you get into the sport and you're racing nationally, whichever country you're in, to then make a step up to World Cup is very difficult. It's very intimidating. You're suddenly on World Cup courses, which generally are a lot more, a lot harder than a national course in a lot of areas. And again, the kind of trying to create a balance on the courses where you're challenging the women in a way that isn't either lessening the challenge for the men or making it more dangerous for the women is a really difficult one. You still want to see the riders that can jump. You still want to see them jump because that, you know, if they got that skill, then they deserve to have a result that's based on their ability. So you don't want to, you know, you don't want to have a big jump for the guys that then the women, you have to put something that can roll down the side. That's not the way it works. So then it's that balance is very, very hard to find. And I think I'm really happy that we've got Miriam now on as an athlete rep, because I think she can bring a lot to the table about what she thinks and what her peer group think is the way to encourage more women into the sport and how we can, you know, how we can help organizers create courses that challenge the guys as well as the women to, you know, without making it too difficult for one or too easy for another.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you. Appreciate your answers to all that. It's been really interesting. We've got three questions that we've asked most of our guests, and I'd like to get your thoughts on them as well before we finish up, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So the first one is, if our listeners had £100 to spend to help improve their performance on the bike, can be on anything you like, kit, training, anything, what would you personally recommend they spend that money on?
Oh, we're talking downhill specific, are we?
Well, mountain biking in general.
Mountain biking in general. Oh, £100. God, that's difficult. You know what? I'm really struggling with that one. I think a bit of riding kit that means you can go out in all weathers and be comfortable. I think you don't want weather putting you off. So like for £100, you can get a pretty good bit of clothing that would encourage you to still go out, ride your bike.
Yeah, it makes sense. Waterproof shorts, something like that.
There you go.
Cool, good stuff. Then the other one, if you could wind the clock back and give any advice to your 16-year-old self, what would you tell him?
I think that between the age of 16 and 23, there was probably more to life than just cycling. I probably missed out on a few other kind of areas of life that would have been quite useful at the time that I had to do a bit of catching up on, because I was so into my bike racing that kind of everything else took a bit of a back seat. So I think it would have just been, you could still be the cyclist you want to be, but still have, you know, other things going on in your life.
Yeah, good advice. And then the last one of the three is, if you could choose any rider, let's say from the downhill World Cup circuit, to have a coaching day with, who would it be and why?
Can I pick Tracy Moseley for that, even though she's retired?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, Tracy Moseley. I think she's since she's finished kind of her downhill racing career and kind of gone into enduro, and then kind of, she's done this kind of bucket list of other events that she wanted to do. And I think she's turned into a really well-rounded kind of advocate of racing bikes off-road. And I don't think it matters what shape the bike is or what kind of handlebars it's got or what tires it's got on it. I think she's got a really good grasp on the whole of the off-road cycling sport. And I think she's got a very good way of coaching and encouraging and kind of getting people into the sport. So I think I'd have Tracy.
Awesome. Good answer. Cool. Well, thank you very much for your time today. It's been super interesting to chat and find out more about what you get up to and how the UCI side of things work. So yeah, I think our listeners will really enjoy that. So thanks for your time.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Nice one. Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
All right, that's it for our episode with Simon Burney. It's a little bit different for us, but I think it was real interesting to find out a bit more about what goes on behind the scenes at the UCI. If you're a race organiser and you fancy taking on Schlabbing, I definitely want to see it. So get in touch with us or with the UCI and we can put you in touch. It would be pretty fantastic to see that race venue up and running again. All right, we've got more great stuff coming up for you. Don't forget to head over to social media and follow us. Just check out at Downtime Podcast on Instagram or Facebook, or at Downtime Tweets on Twitter. Head over to our website, downtimepodcast.com. You'll find links there to subscribe to the podcast. You can join our newsletter, and you can also head to the shop and grab yourself a t-shirt. Until next time, get out and ride.